Blog Talk Radio.
Out of the area.
So, what's happening? My name is Eric Payne. Welcome to the Kay Thompson Live Show. I'm normally also known as KNA, right? That's what I have. They're also known as. Also known as the son of the host of the show, Kay Thompson. And you are there you are, lady.
I am Kay Thompson. Hi, Eric. Well, you know, we have really an important show tonight. It's very exciting. And we're going to be talking to Bill Katz, you know, William Lorraine Katz. And he is probably the most prolific writer of African-American history. And Black, and he's written so many books. You know that I always refer to his book, Eyewitness,
right.
You know, which is a documentary on African-Americans and, you know, Africa. And he's just absolutely wonderful. And we are going to be talking to him tonight because he is going to be bringing us, Phil Pompey Dixico, who is from the Maroons. Now, you know, I don't really even know, you know, a lot about the Maroons, but they're a group of people that, we're going to be finding out about, you know, from Bill Katz, Professor Katz, in a minute, as soon as he calls in. So I think he might be on the phone right now. Let's see.
Cool.
Yeah, are you there? Bill Katz?
No, this is Pompey Dixico is here.
Yes, hi Pompey, how are you?
Fine. How are you both, Mr. Eric and Miss Kay? That's nice. So good to be on your show.
I'm glad to have you on again, you know. Listen, we're going to be finding out more than we found out before, you know, and we're waiting now for, you know, Bill Katz to get on, and he's going to be talking with you, too. But listen, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Okay, well, I have a little minute and 45 second way that I'd like to start off, and that'll give you a good idea of who I am. Do I have your permission to go ahead?
Yes, you certainly do.
Okay, racially, I'm an African Native American. Culturally, I'm an aspiring Seminole Maroon descendant. But to the people of America that see me on the street, I'm just another flavor of black. But it's about race. It's not about race. It's about culture. And this show, I believe, can change it. My purpose is to help expand the world's body of knowledge about my ancestors, who were indigenous homeland security defenders and maroon freedom fighters. My goal is to help inspire a cultural renaissance similar to the Harlem Renaissance, except
yes.
Instead of using the new Negro as the protagonist, we use indigenous people and Maroons as the heroes and sheroes. Finally, my dream is that one day, after full disclosure and reconciliation of Western Hemisphere history, that the descendants of the oppressed and the oppressors come together to form an all-inclusive American culture dedicated to freedom, justice, and equality.
Wow. Wow. You know, Pompey, when I talked to you before, you know, I didn't know, I had no information about the Maroons, okay? So can you tell us, you know, while we're waiting for Bill Katz to join us also, can you give us some information? And I'm really very pleased because the fact that, you know, this is history, and I'm just so tickled to be involved in it at all. So give us some more information about, you know, people.
Okay. Well, as you know, Bill is the historian and the writer, and I'm an informed descendant. I really wish that he had called in. He deserves that right, but from my perspective, I would say that Maroons were those enslaved people brought here during the transatlantic slave trade who refused to accept enslavement, and they found ways. Is Bill on?
Pompey, listen.
Yes.
You just pause for a little bit because I think Bill Katz is on the phone.
Yes,
I'm on. I know. Eric is telling me, and Wayne is too. So we have Wayne Gilman, we have Bill Katz, and we have you, Pompey, and we have me. So that's really wonderful. Hello, everybody.
Hi.
Good evening,
hello,
Kay.
Hello.
Bill Katz, are you there?
I sure am.
Okay. And Wayne Gilbert, are you there?
Yes, I am, and it's good to hear his voice again.
Okay.
Nice talking to you all.
Yeah, this is really exciting. Bill, can you? We'll start with you. Tell us about, you know, the Maroons, and tell us about Pompey. He's been telling
us.
Yeah,
let me introduce the whole subject. And I'll introduce Pompey in a minute, because Pompey represents a very important part of this. As many of your listeners know, back in many years ago, 25 years ago or more, I wrote a book called Black Indians.
Yes.
And what I established in that was that the mixture of Africans and Native Americans became our first freedom fighters. Long before Thomas Jefferson, the Declaration of Independence, Ben Franklin, Give Me Liberty or Give Me Death by Patrick Henry, people of African descent and people of Native American descent were uniting to fight for freedom in the Americas. And it's a heroic story. And Pompey is a part of it. His ancestors certainly were involved. But let me just go on and tell you how this started.
Okay.
The first people enslaved in the Americas were Native Americans. When the conquistadors came over, the British merchants and so on, they seized the first people they could. And that could have been in Florida. It could have been in Brazil. It could have been where I'm sitting in Manhattan, or where Pompey is sitting out in California, or where you're sitting in New Jersey. And so, when the same people were brought in Africans as slaves, the Native Americans knew that he was a potential ally. Many of them had escaped back to their villages and were carrying on a resistance. And they welcomed the Africans. It wasn't a matter of skin color. It was a matter of a common enemy. And this went on to such a point that by 1503, that's just a few years after Columbus landed in 1492, Governor Ovando of Hispaniola is reporting his African slaves fled to the Indians, and he uses this four-word phrase, never could be captured. And I think what he has captured in that sentence is the formation of the first rainbow coalition in the Americas, the mixing of two people behind a single plan of freedom. And let me just say, this coming together took place everywhere, from Canada south into the Americas, along the Atlantic coast, in New England, out in California, down to Panama, across into the Caribbean, down into South America. And it was a very strong alliance. The leaders had to be strong. The Europeans were trying to crush their colonies. And let me pause at this moment to use a word that people should learn about. It's the word maroon. These colonies of Africans and Native Americans were called maroon colonies. Mm-hmm. And their goal was to just bring up their children, raise crops, feed their family, take care of their wives, and live in freedom. But the Europeans they escaped from, of course, wanted the Indians' land and wanted the Africans as laborers. So that's where you get to the founding myth of this country, is that world liberty began in 1776 with the Minutemen at Concord, the Declaration of Independence, and so on, when actually it began back at the time of Columbus. And the first people enslaved were the first people to resist. And the second people, the Africans, to be enslaved was the second to resist. And it was natural they formed alliances. Now, what Pompey has done, and I'm going to introduce him in a moment, is he has been invited just a month or so ago to a gathering down in South America, in to be exact, it's in Suriname, and it was called Maroon Day. And let me just introduce Pompey to tell you a little bit about that. Pompey Fixico, I met a few years ago when he introduced me when I was the keynote speaker at an Underground Railroad conference on the Underground Railroad most people don't know about that ran south. It didn't run north up to Canada, didn't have Harriet Tubman and those names we know, but it ran south into Texas, Africans escaping to Indians, then getting to Mexico with their help. It ran south into Florida, slaves escaping, going to Florida, where, by the way, they became the first real colonists of Florida. Spain claimed it, but the Africans really ran the place. And then when the Seminole Nation, a breakoff province of the Creek Nation, finding they were oppressed, headed south into Florida, the Africans welcomed them with open arms and taught the methods of rice cultivation that the Africans had learned in Senegambia and Sierra Leone. And on this basis, these two people of color formed a agricultural and military alliance. It grew in strength, it grew to thousands of members, and it held off slave catchers for a long while. And when the United States purchased Florida, by the way, one of the main reasons the United States purchased Florida was to keep this place, not to keep it, to destroy this bastion for runaway slaves, to defeat this alliance and Rainbow Coalition. Well, the United States went to war against this, what should we call it, Black Seminole Alliance. And it, for 42 years, in the late, early 19th century, they fought. And they fought. And they never really defeated. They agreed to move west finally. But they stood their ground. And by the way, they were facing the strongest armies at the time, in with the British, the Spanish, and later the American armies. But they didn't give up. They kept fighting. And as they did, by the way, they had to do something other armies didn't have to do. They protect their families. They had to move them out of harm's way. Now, let me introduce Pompey Fixico. Phil Pompey Fixico. First of all, he's president of the Semeroon Historical Society. He has been invited as the representative of the North American Maroons down to Suriname to celebrate Maroon Day.
Wow.
He was invited by Dr. Ambassador Fidelia Grand Gallon, if I'm pronouncing that right. And it was the 255th anniversary celebration of the Treaty of 1760, in which the Dutch agreed, who were in charge there, they thought, in Suriname, that they had defeated the Maroons, but they had to concede they hadn't, and they granted them their rights. Pompey, why don't you take it from there? Tell us a little bit about that visit, what you had in mind, and what happened.
Thank you very much, Bill, and Mr. Eric, and Ms. Kay Thompson for having me on the show. And I would just I would just like to salute Mr. William L. Katz for his courage over the years. And it took a lot of guts for him to step forward and speak for the oppressed and for my ancestors all these years. And I would just like to say God bless you, Mr. William L. Katz.
Thank you.
I was chosen by the Maroon Women Chamber of Cooperation. These are women who represent the Maroons of Jamaica, Trinidad, Tobago, and Suriname, which would be the largest Maroon enclave in the Western Hemisphere. You put them all together as the North American Maroon representative to Suriname Maroon Day. It was called Operation Suriname Maroon Day. They had vetted me. They had investigated me. They had looked at my networks. They had studied my writings. I had to submit so much. I went through something similar to that when the Smithsonian Institution's researcher, Dr. Kevin Mulroy, did a 16,000-word essay on me and six generations of my family. But this was very intense, and I had no idea really totally what to expect. I went there, and I was there for 13 days, and I visited 10 Maroon villages on two of the rivers, the Tappanahoni River, the Kotika River, and also I met a young there in Paramaribo. I did a ceremony at the Royal Assembly House for the Candamasa Da Bono Valente, the paramount chief of the Okanisi in the Yuka Maroons, and there's six Maroon nations there, and they have settled around the rivers, and they're still in place on the land that they won, and it was just an awesome experience.
Wow.
You know, let me just step in here and said, you one of the things you wrote, Pompey, was that in the ceremonies that you attended, you said thousands participated in some way. What did you mean by that?
Well, in saying that, I really was saying that it was North America. My networks represent my blood cousins and my extended cousins, but I went to South America to form a reunification or a unification of my cultural cousins who had went through the same requirements to become Maroons as Seminole Maroons had. They had went through it also. They didn't know that there were even many of them didn't know, have an idea that there were Maroons here in the United States. And, of course, many people in the United States didn't know. So it did affect and impact thousands. Me going to these 10 villages, up these rivers, up these trails, and flying in these little charter planes over the deepest part of the rainforest. And they spent money to make this happen through without being funded. They thought it was of that great enough importance. And these were women who are, you know, I recently did a presentation at the Compton Library, and it was a young man there as it got heated. He said, so tell us, what is it that the Maroons had that made them different and made them successful in their resistance to slavery or enslavement? And I said, I'm so glad you asked me that. What they had was cooperation.
See, what Pompey did by going there and accepting their invitation was to represent and symbolize the coming together for the first time of Maroon people or the descendants of Maroon people here in the Americas. And it was a first. I just want to add also that in 2012, when Pompey and I attended this gathering in Florida to talk about the Underground Railroad, Pompey conducted a peace ceremony. And Pompey, could you just briefly tell the two groups you brought together at that moment?
Yes, well, the symbolism of the groups were the Yamasee, the Gullah Geechee, and the Black Seminole. And, of course, I also represented the Black Seminole. And they had since 1715, they had been divided. And you were there at the ceremony, and your lovely wife, Lori. And it really was touching.
Wow.
Let me just interrupt
you both for a minute. This is history. You know, I have to admit that I know little about the Maroons, so this is really an honor, you know, to be for you, Bill Katz, to introduce me to Pompey, to you, Pompey, and to give us all this history. I thought I knew a lot, but I don't. So I'm really honored. You know, this is really an honor.
I might add, I also find this fascinating because for years I always heard the Maroons equated with the island
Wayne
of Jamaica.
Yeah.
Yeah, Kay and Dr. Katz and Pompey, Wayne Gilman, I'm one of the co-hosts. And the thing is that I find it so fascinating that the Maroons had an involvement in this country because, particularly going back to my time at WLIB, all we ever heard were the Maroons and Jamaica. I'm a native of Trinidad and Tobago. I didn't even know that the Maroons had involvement there, too, with respect to the slave trade, you know?
Yes, well,
this is fascinating information.
Let me just say that this is what drew me to it. In writing my book, Black Indians, I kept coming on these groups of freedom fighters who nobody knew about. They're not part of any American history textbook. And by the way, there's a very good reason. These people were fighting against the very people who were slaveholders and went on to write the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. So they had natural enemies and no historians to really record what they had done. And that's why we have to get this story out. Children in school have to learn this story. It didn't all begin with Thomas Jefferson and Patrick Henry.
And concerning the Trinidad Tobago, this is part of the Maroon Women Chamber of Cooperation, their leader. And what important thing about the Maroons there is they were African Americans here. And during the War of 1812, they fought for the British as colonial Marines, and when Britain lost the war, they say, well, we promised you freedom. If you fought for us, we'll let you go to one of our territories. And so they shipped five companies of those colonial Marines that were Black and their families to Trinidad and Tobago, and they're known as the Americans. That's their corrupted way of saying Americans, the Americans. And so I'm part of that chamber of cooperation that includes the Americans of Trinidad and Tobago.
Pompey, would you tell about your family, the Cesar Bruner family in Florida?
Yes, well, my great grandfather, Papa Cesar Bruner, he would be equivalent to one of the most so-called Black Indians in Oklahoma. He was the leader. There's 14 bands within the Oklahoma Seminole Nation. Two of them are Black. He was the leader of one, and one still carries his name. In addition, he was married to Mama Nancy, and her grandfather was Prophet Abraham, who was at and helped build and was at Fort Negro. And this is a, you know, to tell you about Fort Negro, this is a serious Maroon story that needs to come out because it was a tragic taxpayer-sponsored slave hunting expedition by U.S. military forces who were ordered to illegally violate Spanish territory sovereignty. But, Bill, can you tell them a little bit about,
yeah.
You're the historian, about Fort Negro?
Well,
Fort Negro
was one of Fort Negro was invaded by the United States, and it was a mixture of Africans and Native Americans who had taken over an old British fort, and the Americans luckily landed for them a heated cannonball in the ammunition dump, and it blew the place to smithereens. So the Americans thought from there on it was going to be easy ending this alliance, taking over Florida. But as I said, what happened was a 42-year war in which the Seminoles, black and red, ran circles around the U.S. Army, Navy, and Marines. And they continued to do this to a point where it cost $40 million to fight this war for the United States. And by the way, that's 1830s dollars. That's not this year's. The United States lost 1,500 military lives. Half of the U.S. Army was tied up in Florida. This was the largest so-called Indian War up to that point.
And
now,
it was
Kay,
in Spanish territory.
Excuse me?
No, I said it was in Spanish territory, and I had ancestors in and around Fort Negro that were Maroons, but they had come from a village in Georgia that was Seminole, and that's where the army went to attack them, and they were ready to fight because their people who were at Fort Negro had already been destroyed. Next year is going to be the bicentennial celebration of it, but it's kept sort of hidden and forbidden.
Oh, you're right. Let me just add, by the way, that
I just have a quick question. I was just wondering, where do the Maroons descend from in Africa? Where is their origin? What part of Africa?
Well, these were Africans. They were not Maroons in Africa. They were independent people leading their lives, contributing to their community when they were seized and put aboard slave ships. But let me just tell you this part. See, the story is much broader than this. With this Maroon gathering that Pompey Fixico attended representing North America had branches throughout the Americas. There was a woman named Maria Felipa Arana, an African woman who ran her own black Indian colony, Maroon colony, in northeast Brazil. In the center of Brazil, in Palmares, 11,000 people, Africans and Native Americans, built an entire city. By the way, at the time, New York only had a population of a few thousand. They had a leader, Genga Zumba, which combined an African and a Tupi Indian word for great leader. And here are our first freedom fighters, not the ones we've been taught in school.
Wow.
Another point to that question, to answer that question, the Seminole Maroons, their ancestry can be traced back through Sierra Leone, through linguistics. But the Jamaican, there's the Ashanti, there's the Cromanti, and also in Suriname. So they have African retentions. That's another thing that's strong among the Maroons. They have retain some of their African culture stronger than those people that were conquered and assimilated.
Wow.
Let me add that today the instances of these two people being together are captured in some names that everybody's familiar with. Beyonce, LL Cool J, Michael Jackson, Jesse Jackson, Martin Luther King, Jimi Hendrix, Lena Horne, just to name a few.
Yeah.
So
the
traditions live on.
Okay.
Now, I don't know how much time we have. Kay, you said finished it.
Right. We're going to have to wrap this up right now. But I'm inviting you back. I'm inviting both of you back, you know, for let's schedule you for like about week after next, because this is some really, really, really good history. Now, I know that, you know, about the Seminole Nation. I know about the Kickapoos and the Shawnees and the Delawares and the Comanches, including the Cherokees and, you know, the Creeks. And it's just so many tribes that we don't know about and don't know enough about. And I have to say that Bill Katz is because of you writing Black Indians and a number of other books. So you've got to come back again. And
sure.
I'm delighted.
Sure, no, we'll be happy. But Pompey and I have been on a number of radio programs, and we've teamed up over the last few years. We'll be happy to come back. Let me just mention my website.
Okay,
those who want to read more about this for free, it's williamlkatz.com. And you can read a number of my articles there. On the front page, there's material on Pompey Fixico and his attending the conference and what it was all about.
Okay, that's terrific. Now, give me that one more time here, where you're we're joined by Bob Law. He's waiting, and we're going to be talking to him. But give me your site again, your page again, Bill.
Yes, it's williamlkatz.com. And you can find information there, a lot of essays. If you want to order my books, there's a way to do that at the site. And I really enjoyed being on with Pompey. He's a real hero. He's undertaken to do this for years and trace his ancestors, and he's got a lot to say, and we'll be happy to be on again.
Okay, thank you both. It's a lot of information.
Thank you.
And I can't wait to hear it again. Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank
all right.
you.
Thank you, yeah.
And right now we are going to be talking to Bob Law. You know, Bob Law is joining us, Eric, and Wayne. So I think he's on the air right now. Bob, are you there?
I'm here.
Bob Law. Did you get information?
Hey.
Did you get a lot of that information, Bob?
From William Katz?
Yes.
Sure. You know, I've interviewed William Katz a number of times. He may not remember me. But,
he's fascinating, I'm telling you. And then with Pompey and the Maroons, I'm ashamed to say that I had not heard about the Maroons. I did not read enough, apparently, but I know about it now. And with the Bill Katz books, he has so many books out, and I can't believe that I didn't know about the Maroons. I'm annoyed. I'm angry. But anyway, Bubba, how are you? How the heck are you?
I'm good. I'm fine.
And what are we talking about?
See,
what are we talking about?
You want for me to keep? I'm trying to give you these one word answers. Make you work. Make you
I
do
got
this
a
interview
for Bob. For Bob Law.
Yes, yes.
If I might, I'm sorry to interrupt. I just happened to look at YouTube every once in a while since I'm so bored in my retirement. And I'm from the old school, and I know you have a huge musical background. And I happen to see a video of the Teenagers, not with Frankie Lyman, of course, but one of your former colleagues, Bobby J. And I was just wondering, I mean, I know Bobby had worked for you and a number of the other successful RL's Super 16 DJs. What's become, or I know some of them have died, regrettably, but what's Bobby doing these days?
Bobby is performing with the Teenagers. Still. They are still performing. They don't do splits as much as they had done before, but they still perform, and he's doing a blog radio show where he features the music of his real generation, you know. He really is what came out of the doo-wop generation, and Bobby J is the most knowledgeable person about the doo-wop era and the music of anybody in the country. People have written books. I have a conversation with Bobby J on tape that he's supposed to take to and have it transcribed, and then it'll be on paper, and then he could take it to an editor, and they can put it together into a book with all the information that Bobby J has. But he is living in the South. I don't remember exactly where. I hear from him periodically. He's still performing from time to time. He's doing special, you know, those special oldies shows that are popular.
Yeah, yeah, everyone, right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but those shows are popular globally, you know. And
right.
So he's performing with the Teenagers. I think Jimmy Merchant, I think that one of the original Teenagers, and Bobby was almost one of the original Teenagers. He was right there with them during the Frankie Lyman era. And
oh, okay.
Bobby J and Jimmy Castor used to sit in for, Jimmy Castor would sit in for Frankie Lyman from time to time. And, and Bobby J was part of that group even then. And he had a group of his own called the Laddins.
Right,
but,
right.
He is enjoying, he's still enjoying the music that he really loves.
Well, that's good to hear.
Hey, Wayne, Mr. Long, how you doing? This is Eric.
Eric.
Maybe we could shift the conversation a little bit. You know, I know that we were talking about just things going on in politics and all that
mm-hmm.
stuff last week, and I'm interested to hear your perspective about, you know, this recent development in Chicago where they kind of put the blame on the police chief
mm-hmm.
and he ended up resigning. But, you know, it's really kind of Rahm Emanuel in my perspective and the prosecutor.
Mm-hmm.
The Alvarez woman who tried, obviously, you know, the implications of it. You know, like, let's discuss that a little bit. What you guys think, you and Wayne?
See, one of the things that's happening is that we began this movement for economic withdrawal. And one of the things that is happening is that that whole idea of using your money strategically, holding on
mm-hmm.
to your money, is beginning to catch on. And Black Friday sales were down, I am told, by $1 billion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the corporations are not going to say that it had anything to do with the economic withdrawal movement, this no justice, no profit. That is the movement. They're not going
right.
to say that. Even if we could empty the stores, they wouldn't say that. What they're saying is that online shopping went up 14%, but that 14% doesn't represent $1 billion. But what's happening is that in various places, first you saw Jonathan Butler, who went on a hunger strike in Missouri, in Mizzou,
mm-hmm.
right? And he went on the hunger strike, and the school couldn't care less about this young brother and his hunger
right.
strike. They were going to let him starve. But he said that he would go without food. And when he said that, his classmates and schoolmates said, "We'll go without football." When they said, "We'll go without football," that meant that the school was going to have to pay $1 million cancellation fee.
Right.
And they would also lose all of the money that is part of college football on game day. There's television rights, and there's rental fees, and there's vendors, and there's all kind of things. When the football team said that we won't play football, they hit them right in the pocket.
Mm-hmm.
In Chicago, the demonstrators... And as a result, the president of the college was, the policymakers instructed the president of the college to resign, which is what Jonathan Butler had in mind when he launched the hunger strike.
Right.
In Chicago, the demonstrators were very orderly and they were moving strategically. And they walked down to Michigan Avenue. Michigan Avenue, as you know, is the major, major shopping fair, thoroughfare in Chicago. They
mm-hmm.
were on Michigan Avenue blocking commerce, blocking business as usual. When the corporations saw that loss of income, and when the corporations saw that they not only were they blocking commerce, but there were many people who decided to stay home. They didn't want to be caught up in that. And so
right.
they just stayed home that day. That's when the corporation said, that's when the policymakers said, fire the police chief.
Right.
And see, the strategy that we've been talking about is exactly that. That if we use our See, what we tend to do is brag about how much money we spend. So black marketing firms and ad agencies and people, like, they point out that black people spend over $1 trillion a year. And so that's something that we are very pleased with and very, very proud of. And we're saying to Madison Avenue, black people spend over $1 trillion a year, so you should spend money in black media and you should do more with black businesses. And for the most part, you should hire black ad agencies, you should spend money in black media, because black people spend over $1 trillion a year. The ad agencies and the corporations' response really is, if we're getting over $1 trillion a year without you, why do we need to spend money in black media? Why do we need to spend money with a black ad agency marketing to black people when we get over $1 trillion a year without you?
Mm-hmm.
So this whole strategy of going to them and saying how much we spend can't possibly impress any thoughtful people.
Mm-hmm.
That we're saying you already spend all this money. We're not even asking you all to spend this money. We don't advertise in black radio. We don't advertise in black media. We don't put money in black media. And look at this money that you're spending with us. So one of the things that we have said is that it is not how much you spend, but it is how efficiently you control your spending. It's when you don't spend that you demand respect. And when we look at these major corporations that show a depraved disregard for black life, they don't support any of our struggles for justice. They don't support, they don't put any money in the black community in a meaningful way. Look at the fast food industry. There are six times as many fast food restaurants in the black community as in the white community. Black people eat more fast food than any other ethnic group in the country. Fast food industry does not buy potatoes from black farmers. You know, it's not buying anything from black folk. It's not using the black ad agencies. It's not spending any money in black media. As much money as black folks spend in McDonald's and Wendy's and Burger King, none of them feel compelled to advertise in black media. And when we raise an issue for issue around justice, they ignore it. Now, corporations do take political positions. Corporations they support guns, they support the NRA, they take positions against gay marriage, they take positions in support of gay marriage, they take positions most often in support of the police departments around the country. They take political positions, but they never take a political position that supports black folk struggling for equal justice in this society. So they don't run full page ads, you know.
Right.
You
could say there's a philosophy, right? What comes to mind when you mention that to me, it just kind of spurs the notion that here in Mitt Romney said corporations are our people, which was ridiculous, but it really is. They are the philosophy of what you're talking about, to not support anything black or anything and pro NRA and these other things, are really the philosophy of cats like the Koch brothers who own these corporations, right? And this is the way they infect or influence our culture and to keep that kind of status quo of, you know, white is right and the whole imperialistic nature.
See, the Koch brothers is a good example. They own the corporations. They are corporations who, and they raise money and they donate money to right-wing political causes. Regardless of whether they were right-wing or left-wing, the Koch brothers spend their corporate dollars on political causes that they are in support of.
Right.
Somehow, there isn't any major corporation that's in support of any political cause that we raise, no matter what it is. They don't support us on a political level. They don't reinvest on an economic level. But they continue to receive money, enormous amounts of money, from black consumer dollars. And black people are bragging about how much money we are spending with people who never even ask us to spend the money. In fact, when you come into some of those stores, they follow you around the store like they don't even want your money. Right? So the economic withdrawal campaign is something that Dr. King called for about 50 years ago, the night before he was assassinated in Memphis, and he said that we need to launch an economic withdrawal campaign. We must always attach economic withdrawal to our external direct action. And he said we have to find a way to redistribute the pain. So Jonathan Butler is willing to experience the pain. He's going to go without food. He's going to be on a hunger strike. And he's the only one who's feeling the pain until his schoolmate said, we're going to redistribute the pain. We won't play football. Then the same thing happened in Chicago. When they go downtown to Michigan Avenue, they say, we're going to redistribute the pain. And people will not, no more business as usual. And in response to that, the policymakers and the corporate and the political level intervene and move to correct some of the injustice. But they don't do it because we are right. They don't do it because we have raised the right question or that we have put our argument together in a very tight, undeniable manner. They don't do it because of any of those reasons. These are some stiff-necked, wicked people. And they did it, and they will respond to us only because they feel compelled to do so. And they are compelled to do so because we have found a way to redistribute the pain. And so we hold on to our dollars. And at the same time that we're holding on to our dollars, we are redirecting some of that money back into the black community ourselves. So while we're calling on people to reinvest in the community, it is only intelligent that we would begin to reinvest in the black community ourselves. And so people in various cities are conducting shopping tours, black dollar shopping tours, black cash mobs. I took people shopping in three black businesses and a restaurant. This past Saturday is the fourth black cash mob that we've done. Some young activists in Harlem did the same thing. We're hearing it coming up in other cities. And as we begin to get emails and get articles online about this economic withdrawal, more and more people are saying, let's start to redirect some of that $1 trillion back into our own community. Understand this, black people spend 2% of their money with black businesses. And black people have all kinds of reasons why they can't support a black business. But the real reason is that supporting the businesses that are owned by other ethnic groups is emotionally gratifying for many of our people. So especially if you think they don't respect you. See, black people are under the illusion that you can buy social acceptance. So if you don't think they don't want you, you can go into a store and let it and be an upscale store because you think that they don't really want you in the upscale store. So one of the things that you do for your own emotional gratification is go into the upscale store like Barney's.
How much money you could give them.
That's right. And show them that you're making a mistake by not catering to me. You're making a mistake. Right. And let me show you how much money I have, and how much money I'm willing to spend. But that's beginning to turn around. That is what is encouraging. That's beginning to turn around. The first industry that we have targeted is the fast food industry. And we could get black. Yes.
Yeah, I hate to interrupt again. And the thing is, I'm not throwing cold water on what you've raised some very salient points. But, you know, having covered, you know, the media and being involved in the media the last almost 40 years now, mm-hmm. I remember the Black Solidarity Day movement. I'm certain you go back to that time with Carlos Russell and others who forged a similar movement. And I guess the thing that bothers me is that you're coming out with factual information. How do we galvanize this process on a regular basis to get all of us to think in lockstep? Because it just seems like these movements start and then suddenly they die.
Well, it is difficult to get it out on a regular basis because one of the things that we are the victim of is the assault on black media. And so black media doesn't exist. However, it is getting out. Some social media has been helpful. This alternative media has been very helpful. the internet has been helpful, and then the activists in the street. You know, we don't have black radio in Chicago. There's WOL, which is the black talk station. It's the AM station. It's the black talk station in Chicago. I don't know if there's another one. WBMX and those other stations are playing music, if they even still play music. If they might be doing sports talk. However, look at the numbers of people who were in the street in Chicago. That's without black radio. So it's happening.
Gotcha.
The word is moving around the country. It's moving around the street. And there's a change now. There's a different attitude. It worked even then. See, when you talk about Carlos Russell and Reggie Butts and the people who created Black Solidarity Day, Black Solidarity Day worked when it was first created, but Black Solidarity Day was introduced into a political climate that was already very black conscious, very black power. There was a black political movement. And as that movement began to decline, it didn't just decline, but white supremacy began to attack that movement and hiring black people and putting black people, as we used to say, black faces in high places and confusing black people. Black people began to think that, well, we're winning. There's no point in, you know, we've got this, John Johnson is on ABC and Felipe Geraldo is on ABC and there's black folk on television and stuff. And so it looks like we're winning. It looks like we're making progress. And that was the reason. And since those guys would never give any credit to the movement in the street for getting in their job, the only person who did that was Bob Teague. But the rest of the black folk who got into the media, they pretended that they got into the media because they were talented. That they were, and that they interviewed well. But that's a whole other conversation about what happened to black media and black folk in the media. You know, but this is a little bit different now. This is another generation, and it's a generation that is hearing things a little differently. And there's some other voices that have been talking for some time that a lot of people, particularly people in the general media, have not been aware of us. So a lot of people have been talking. Claude Anderson has been talking all over the country. How many people are aware? You see, there's like an underground movement. There's an electronic underground railroad operating. And, you know, so how many people know, black folk know Claude Anderson? Black folk know Umar Johnson. Black folk know Bob Law. Black folk know Jim Clingman. You know, there have been some folk out here who have been preaching this same message, and it's getting over. And people are responding. And see, they learned a thing from the Million Man March, but it seems like they forgot it. See, if you remember the Million Man March, every prominent black and white political personality said, don't go. Rangel said, don't go. Everybody said, even Jesse said, don't go. Every prominent, Giuliani said, don't go. Dinkins said, don't go. Every prominent black and white political personality said, don't go. The only person who didn't say, don't go was Reverend Sharpton, because he's my buddy, so he wouldn't take a position against something that I'm doing. But he didn't say, go. But he wouldn't say don't go. All of them said don't go.
I remember.
All
I was there.
Wait a minute. Here's the point. All of the prominent political personalities said don't go. Did you go?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was there.
More than a million. More than a million. And see, the message was that the people that these policymakers have been turning to as the leaders have not been the leaders. All of them said don't go. I was on the air in New York. Every political personality in the city said, don't go. I said, go, and they went. Me and Bird saying, go, and they went. And the message was that our people are listening to some other voices. And Jimmy Breslin, in his column, I think he was being published in the Daily News at the time, he did a column maybe the day before the march or the day after the march, and where he literally said, how did this happen under our noses? How did we let this happen? We ignored it up until three days before the march.
As you know, that someone's not quite on your level of thing, but as brothers in the street, we were all gone regardless. And I was actually with my uncle, Congressman Payne, who spoke, as you remember. He spoke up there on the dais. So I know that maybe the mainstream politicians, the ones who whose career was vested in kind of keeping the status quo that you're talking about, but I can tell you for a fact that every brother that I was talking to was going to the Million Man March. So I don't
absolutely
remember kind of the blanket.
It was
I don't
different.
Remember kind of
and
the
what
blanket, the blanket denial of not going. I just remember that we were all down to go. And actually, to be quite
everybody
honest, back in that time, as someone who was in Malcolm X and studied with the FOIs for a couple of weeks, all the brothers at that time, you remember Minister Farrakhan was really on there. And we were just running up on 90 seconds, so our conversation once again has gotten really good.
Well, let me ask you this.
And maybe we can
do it again. Let me ask you this, though. Is this the show where they don't allow the women to talk? Where is Kay Thompson?
Well, my mom spoke the second half, and it's my second. So we want to thank you, Bob Law, for being our guest. We want to thank William Katz and the brother, the Indian brother, I forget his name.
Yes,
Molly.
Tom P. And Bill Katz, yes. Come back, Bob.
We got to do it again, Mr. Law. I always get into these conversations. So many segments of the conversation that I want to hear your perspective on. We want to thank you once again.
Right.
Wayne Gilman,
right,
our co-host.
Then. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. Wayne, once again, we've done it again. We'll have another show. Always listen to the Kay Thompson Live Show every Wednesday, 8 to 9 p.m. live, or you can listen to the archived episodes at blogtalkradio.com/Thompson Live. My name is Eric Payne. I'm the son. You're our...
I'm Kay Thompson. Everyone, join us every Wednesday from 8 to 9 p.m.
And Brother Wayne, you still
there? Peace. Yeah, I'm still here.
All right.
Okay, all the best.
Bye.